So I have two notable mentions and then the best award. The notable mentions go to autonomous exploration, active learning, and human guidance with open source Poppy humanoid robot platform and Explauto library. And this was from Sebastian Forestier, Yuan Mollard, and Pierre-Yves Audeyer. And this was a lovely demo with a robot learning to control another robot using intrinsic motivation, curiosity. The second one is Neural Puppet, and that's from Tom White. And this was also a very lovely demo put on this evening. We can thank these notable mentions. And the award for the best demo goes to interactive musical improvisation with Magenta from the Magenta Google Brain team, including Adam Roberts, Jesse Engel, Curtis Hawthorne, Ian Simon, Elliot Waite, Sajiv Ur, Chinyon Resnick, and Douglas Eck. Congratulations. And I think Adam is here.
Good morning, everybody. It's my great pleasure to introduce this year's Breimann Lecture. The Breimann Lecture is supposed to be used to tighten the connections between the statistics community and the machine learning community, because both of our communities work on similar problems, but with different sets of people, and we are visiting different conferences. So the idea is each year we try to bring one person from statistics to machine learning to our community, and to select a person where we think we can learn something from that person. And we selected Susan Holmes. I met her, in fact, a couple of years ago at NIPS, and I thought she had many interesting things to say, and this is why we invited her. Susan works on the somehow on the interface between statistics and biology and also applied mathematics. She publishes in all these three areas in a quite successful way. She was brought up in the French School of Statistics in Montpellier. Then she moved to various well-known places like MIT, Harvard, Cornell, and since 1998, she's professor for statistics at Stanford. She received quite a number of awards, just to mention a few of them. 2005, she became a fellow of the IMS Institute of Mathematical Sciences. In 2013, she got a Director's Transformative Research Award from the NIH. And in 2015, she became a fellow of the Fields Institute in Mathematical Science. So it's my great pleasure to have Susan here and tell us about her work.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I'm not a machine learning person per se. I'm a statistician, very applied statistician. I work mostly with biologists. I'm used to giving talks to biologists. And so this isn't my standard audience, but there are problems that come up in the kind of biology I work in where I think this community has a lot to say. And I'm going to present one particular application. I work in many different areas, and I'm just going to concentrate on the microbiome because I think it's an interesting subject. And it's an interesting subject because it's multi-domain data, which many of you are grappling with right now. And it's multi-domain data that has enough complexity and difficulties that it's not easy for biologists to interact with their data. So mainly, I develop tools for biologists so that they can do their analyses because they have the questions in mind of what they want to do. So the human microbiome, there are various projects I'm involved in. It's many levels of complexity. There's very complicated ones which have to do with what's going on in our gut, in the intestine. For instance, we can measure what happens when you take antibiotics, or you perturb your diet, or you do colonic clean out. Those are perturbations in longitudinal studies that we have. And another study that we're doing, which is giving very positive results for biomarkers, is a study of preterm birth and studies of pregnancy. So I'll present that work, which is joint work with David Rellman's group. So here are some of the challenges that we have. Heterogeneity is definitely one of them. And homoscedasticity is a sort of different level of heterogeneity, but I'll also talk about that. And something which is
interesting because we think, oh, this is an age of big data where we have as much data as we like, but we find that we have enormous amounts of information leak through the pipeline that bioinformaticians are building, and we've had to deal with that. The other thing is we like to integrate, I work a lot on trees and graphs and how to integrate counts with this type of data. We then have the problem of multiplicity of choices, and we'll see that many of the biologists who interact with their data, you can do things in different orders, and we have to worry about whether you get the same result at the end. And I'll talk about the practical implementations that we've decided upon to try to improve the reproducibility both at the level of the experiments and the results. So heterogeneity, what do I mean by that? The heterogeneity of the data, which is the first challenge, first of all, we have sometimes a response, in which case we're doing supervised methods, and sometimes we are doing unsupervised. That is, we have exploratory, unsupervised clustering, or trying to find structure in the data where we don't have a particular response. So, underlying many of the phenomena is a certain amount of heterogeneity, and in that case we can do clustering, in which case we have an underlying latent categorical variable, and sometimes we have an underlying gradient. But in both of those cases, there's a latent variable which is not measured, and it's only rare that we're measuring absolutely everything which is important. We have different types of data, so the continuous and binary, categorical, of course, we use a lot of genetic sequences. We have phylogenetic trees and graphs of interactions between metabolites. We use image data and spatial information. We have rankings. We have the tree and graphs themselves, which we make distances between. And then we have to deal with amounts of dependency. As I said, the studies that we do mostly are longitudinal, so we have time series, but we also have spatial data. So none of the standard statistical frameworks of having IID samples apply here. So we have to work with that. We have many different types of technology, and although that can be seen as something which doesn't have to do with statistics, in fact, the noise models that we have actually do depend on the details. So what is a microbiome? And there are many of them which are important to people. The soil itself from which we grow plants is a microbiome. That is, it's a community of bacteria which are working to produce chemicals and use the environment that they're in. Water treatment plants are microbiomes. They're made up of bacteria which are put together, and they're used for getting rid of some of the pathological parts in a water treatment, but it really has an ecological context in that statement. And then there's the human microbiome. And so within your body, we all have about the same amount of cells which are bacteria. You're mostly bacteria, you can say that. That is, that we have as many bacterial cells as we have human cells. And these bacteria lie in different places and do different things. We associate classically bacteria with things which are pathological, but actually they're the ones that are doing all the important work inside our body of transforming our food into energy and the chemicals that we need to survive. So there are different locations in the body where we have different setups. And as you can see here, each of these locations has been associated to what's called a phylogenetic tree, which is the relationship between all the different bacteria in the tree of life. So these are evolutionary trees which are already known. We don't estimate them from the data that we're going to study, but we're able to find and mark on the tree which are the bacteria which are present in the different environments. And so we have in the mouth a sort of situation of the different bacteria all across the tree, and then, for instance, in the intestines, they're much more localized. So these integration of the tree into the abundance data is one of the things that I'm interested in, and more complex questions. So for instance, in the case of preterm birth, we work hard to try and find biomarkers, that is bacteria, that can help us predict whether delivery will be at the right date or not. Let's talk a little bit more about the data so that you can understand all the techniques that we use. First of all, we use something, a specific housekeeping gene called the 16S RNA gene, and in particular, certain variable regions in it. So this gene is conserved across all bacteria, so all bacteria have it. And within that bacteria, there are regions which are variable from one bacteria to the other, one species or one taxa to another. And they're the fingerprints. They tell us that we have Lactobacillus taxa of a specific type, or that we have Prevotella or different types of bacteria which we're looking for. We also want to know what the bacteria are doing, and there are various ways of measuring that. We have gene expression, which is measured through next-generation sequencing RNA-seq, and that tells us which genes are on and what the bacteria actually are transcribing, and we can measure the outcome of that if in proteomics. So then we use mass spec and NMR to try to have specific signatures of the compounds. We have clinical data, multivariate information about the patients, their weight, the medication they're taking, their clinical status, and we also have environmental data, that is things like diet or the time, the nutrition, the season, various things which are measured on those patients. And we integrate the domain knowledge that we already have, so we have metabolic networks, phylogenetic trees, and gene ontologies. I want to make something clear because there's a certain amount in the biology world and other worlds, there's a strange phenomenon which has come that people are separating out certain types of data away from the other types of data, and they call one type of data the metadata. So metadata is something which was invented by the NSA, and it doesn't exist as far as I'm concerned. All data is data, and we try to keep all the data together. Enormous problems occur if you separate out the metadata from the actual data. So for me, there is no metadata, everything is data. That is the time at which the samples are taken, the state of the patient, all of that is not, it's just clinical data, but it's all data. So we combine this data into an object. We solidify it in some sense so that nothing gets separated out. And so we, in order to do that, we have a pipeline. And so we go from the actual DNA, and we have measurements on the samples, various variables. We put that into what we call a data frame in R. And then we cluster the various and create a denoising algorithm, which enables us, we use data too, but it goes from the sequences to a unique identifier for the different taxa. And those taxa are mapped onto a tree. This is the phylogenetic tree. And that's all combined together into one object so that when afterwards you're manipulating the object, you don't lose any of the covariates. In particular, when we filter and simplify the data, we want this to be automatic and easy for the users. So we've done this through R interface, which is a package in Bioconductor called PhiloSeq, and it allows us to have an object which is very easy for the scientists themselves to manipulate without knowing very much about programming. And in one line or one command, they can plot the types of plots that they like to make. So this is the heat map, which is very popular. Here's a phylogenetic tree with various annotations on it, and richness, and doing bar plots of the different species occurrences is something that they like to do. We have plotting for networks, and networks, communities of bacteria are important ways of visualizing the information. And the workhorse for these types of methods are definitely what's called the ordination methods. So various versions of multidimensional scaling, principal coordinate analysis, are used with very different distances. So many different distances are relevant to this type of data. So the ordination and making biplots, in this case you have on the one hand the samples, on the other hand we have the different taxa. And so that this type of biplot is inherited in the field from ecology. And it's an interesting fact that as we study the human microbiome, people thought about the microbiome as an ecological setting. That is, what we have in our intestines are more than 1,000 different species which are working together in symbiosis with a system. And this symbiosis is beneficial overall, but you can have certain events, perturbations, which make it dysfunctional. And for instance, taking antibiotics is like having a forest fire and everything burns down. And the question is, you know, what grows back? And what grows back the first time you take antibiotics turns out to be very different than what grows back if you take antibiotics 3 times in 3 months. And it's exactly the same as what happens to the ecology of various landscapes when you have forest fires one after the other. So this ecology setting is something which actually people in the clinical field have found very jarring. And so when we're doing clinical studies and we want to try to find, you know, the effects of drugs and pharmacology, the standards for doing statistics and biostatistics are very different than the standards of doing just descriptive exploratory analysis that one has in ecology. So this is a place where the two fields meet, and there's been quite a lot of conflict. That is, of course, the clinical biostatisticians like to have p-values, and they like to have confidence statements. And the ecologists always make very qualitative evaluations of what they're seeing. So we tried to work with some of the what was being done by the ecologists, and the first thing that comes up, which was a real difficulty, is that if you look at the data, so this is an object that comes straight out of our package, in which we have about 19,000 different species of bacteria, 19,000 taxa, and measured on 26 samples. So again, we have a large p, small n problem. And we have sample variables, and we know the phylogenetic tree of the different taxa. But one of the things which is complicating the effect is, here we have the names of the different samples, and each of these samples have very different counts. So the sums of the reads on each sample are very different. And there have been different ways of dealing with this. From ecologists' perspectives, have done this using what's called rarefaction curves and say, we want all the columns to have the same weight, so we're going to subsample every column to a given depth. So for instance, if you say the minimum acceptable column here, NL min, is 10,000, you take a subsample of size 10,000 on every column, and you drop all the other information. So some of the columns are several million, but we're going to lose that information. So what we realized was that procedure, as it was defined by the bioinformaticians, wasn't acceptable from a sort of biostatistics point of view. Another approach to the normalization problem, some people said, well, it doesn't matter. We're going to take within every sample, we'll just look at proportions. But if you look at only the proportions, you lose the information about the variance. And so you can't make inferences if you don't know exactly what the denominators were. And this information was actually lost in many of the bioinformatics pipeline. So as a statistician, we know what we're doing. If we talk about admissibility, we have a procedure which is admissible if it can't be beaten. And doing proportions or taking subsamples are both inadmissible from that viewpoint. So we have this problem of normalizing the data, and we can use models with sufficient statistics, and that requires having a noise model on the way that the data were generated. But in this case, the model's pretty simple. So we use a hierarchical gamma Poisson model. And in that case, we know how to normalize the data in the sense of variance stabilizing. How do you make all the variances the same? We use the delta method, and there's a transformation, the arcsine hyperbolic transformation with various parameters that we can estimate from the data, which allow us to normalize. So this is a case where sort of standard statistics was able to inform the bioinformatics problem and not throw out data. And we just use a simple Poisson model for the technical replicates, and we know that the depth here, the depth of the samples is one parameter and the incidence is another. So this solved, in some sense, the normalization problem. And you can see how the fit is sufficient here for capturing most of the variability. So when you do the gamma Poisson model, which is the same as a negative binomial, you get this fit here, which is much, much better than an ordinary Poisson model. And this is what happens if you just rarefy. That is, if you rarefy, you don't solve the problem, and you don't make them Poisson, which seemed to be what people thought. So from the clinical perspective, it really is important to increase the power of all of your studies, and false discovery rates and improvements in power are the name of the game. That is, we use the area under the curve for the receiver operating curve as our index of how powerful the studies are, and we can see that with these new transformations. So here, for instance, this is a typical transformation that we have. We have an increase in power, which makes it much better. So in some sense, we've solved that problem of the leaky pipeline and the improvement in power. And I want to show you this in an example. And this has to do with preterm birth prediction. So it turns out the U.S. is a country which, with regards to preterm birth, is at about the same level as most third world countries. And so there's more than actually 15 preterm births for 100 births in the U.S., which is comparable. There's some states in the U.S. which are worse than many of the states in Africa. And this is a mystery, and this is something that we're trying to understand. It has a lot to do with the way healthcare works in the US, but it's definitely something which is preoccupation for us. So the data that we have is that we have data on women. As soon as the pregnancy is declared, samples are taken of the vaginal microbiome. Actually, we have samples from every body site, but I'm just going to talk to you about the study on the vaginal microbiome. And we had 50 in this preliminary study. We originally had 40 pregnant women. We've had follow-up studies now confirming these data. And we use this variance stabilizing a negative binomial, but we also use various models for clustering and sample simple Markov chain model to see the longitudinal structure, which fits pretty well. And we were able to, using a random effects model, mixed effects model, and finite state Markov chain, we were able to conclude to differential abundance in various of the bacteria, which were really important. Some of the questions that we were asked by the people who designed the study were, there's a specific different types of community states which were already known before we collected this data, and we wanted to know whether these were consistent or stable across pregnancy, or whether there was a change as the pregnancy went forward. And this is very important when you're trying to do diagnosis. That is, if you can know earlier on that there's a risk of preterm birth, you do much better in helping the patient. So we wanted to see how to represent the data, both statistically, but also because we wanted visualization methods. So first of all, heat maps are very popular. And so in this case, what we have is we have these five different states. And these states were actually predefined in previous studies, and they were different community types. So for each patient, so every sample here is a column, and here, every row is a different type of bacteria. So this is a contingency table with different abundances. And we can see at the top the status with regards to preterm birth. And so the preterm and the very preterm, there's dark pink and light pink. Those give you the cases in which there was preterm birth. And we can see that this community in state four gives a much higher incidence rate of preterm birth. So this was the state that we were the most interested in. And the other states all have particular dominant signature bacteria, most of in the Lactobacillus family. And these lactobacilli, in some sense, are protective. And so we see them for those other states. What we don't see here is a consistent signature. There's not one bacteria which is present in these samples. It's more a very diverse setup. It's interesting because this is actually a case which is counter most of what we see for the microbiome. That is, for the intestinal microbiome, high diversity is sign of health. And in this case, high diversity is not sign of health. That is, these are the cases where we're going to see the preterm. And a good way of representing what's going on is just to look at the different collections of the samples. So each row here is a different patient. And these are the length of the pregnancy. So this is the longest pregnancy, and these are the short ones. So these are the preterm birth. And you can see that many, many of these are in the pink or red states, or, you know, dark pink, light pink states. And here we have a few pink, but they go back and forth in and out of pink. And one of the things you can just see, we tested it, but you can just see it by looking at these, is this very high stability. That is, across the pregnancy, the women stay about in the same state. And we can look at this in terms of a Markov chain, and so we made a Markov chain model here. We have the transition between the different states, and we can see that mostly these are the state 1, 3, 2, 5 are all very, very stable. These arrows, their size represents the probability of a self loop, which is all very, very strong. It's stronger than here. And these are the states which we have the highest, and this one is the one which was the most worrisome. So we have these states that we're trying to explain, and within these states we looked for the bacteria which were most significant using the transformations, and we came up with two suspects, two biomarkers, Gardnerella and Europlasma. And what we did was, once we had those, we looked at a separate sample, a new sample we collected, and looked at the presence of these. And this confirmed and validated the study for this population, that these were the biomarkers for preterm birth. Now, this is not something which is causal at all. These are biomarkers which are associated with risk for preterm birth. Now, I'd like to say that we made lots of different choices, and this is where the reproducible research part comes in. That is, when we made the transformations of the data, when we used the community state types, there are all types of different choices, and so we've documented, and we take the time to represent the whole study, and so we have I can show you here what this looks like. So this is just the web page that comes up, but you have all the R markdown. But you have the R markdown, the HTML of every part and every figure. So you could reproduce completely what was done in this study. And this is an important part of the way we work. So everything is, the data are open, but also all the code, so you can reproduce everything in the paper. And this has helped people who've redone studies, especially for the March of Dimes, in other centers. They've taken their data and they've been able to confirm our results with separate data sets. And so they can run through exactly the same protocol and analyses. The next thing I want to talk about is the side of more complicated multi-domain than just heteroscedasticity. So it's the heterogeneity in the data to a first order in the representation, not in the machine because it's not a sparse or a good way of compressing, but a way of thinking about the data that we have is usually we have time series and we're comparing two different situations. So for instance, we had preterm, non-preterm, but we can have cases and controls, perturbed or not perturbed. The different taxa are associated with phylogenetic trees, so we have representation of a relationship between the columns in this case. And then we have genetic data where we have networks between the different in this case, we have the genes that are expressed or not, and then we have the metabolic data. So if we want to combine all of this together, there are various ways of doing it. Nowadays, there are more evolved sort of kernels. I use inner products between matrices and different types of metrics and measures, which are very useful. I'm just going to give you one example of that. This is called double principal coordinate analysis, and it's used when you know the relationship between the taxa is known through a tree, and you want to represent your samples, but you take into account that distance. So the first thing you do is you make a multidimensional scaling, that is like it's a PCA on distances in some sense, where the distances are the distances between the taxa on the tree. And then once you have the points in Euclidean space, you make those points be weighted by the abundances of the taxa. And each sample is at the center of gravity, or the barycenter, of those weighted points. And then you do a multidimensional scaling on that. And this gives you a way of making map or graphical biplot where you can see how things are changing. So to give you just a small example on a few subjects, we're doing a very large study, more than 150 subjects measured over many months, where the subjects are asked to take antibiotics. They take them twice. When we did the follow-up study, this is the preliminary study, but when we did the follow-up study, we were very worried about recruitment. Now, I'm in the Bay Area, and what's so funny is we put up a website, and within 2 weeks, we had 150 people sign up because they wanted to know about their microbiome, and they were perfectly happy to do colonic clean-out, antibiotics, diet perturbation. The only problem we had was complete homogeneity in the demographics. There were men from the age of 25 to 35 who belonged to a movement called the quantified self. And I'm sure there are many people here, you're exactly that demographic. That is, you're interested in yourself and you're prepared to be guinea pigs. And we had a problem because we wanted the study to be generalizable to a much larger population with old people, women, and so on. But it's an interesting fact that recruitment now for clinical studies is much easier than it used to be. People are very interested in themselves. So here's the type of graphic that we get, this principal coordinate analysis, which shows you, to begin with, you start with a relationship on the tree, and that's the first multidimensional scaling. Here, when you do the principal coordinate analysis, the main thing that you see, and this is always the case, and this is why everything that we do is longitudinal, is the subject-to-subject differences swamps everything else. So it's within subjects that we have to look at everything, and the perturbation that we're going to look at under antibiotic stress, and so I show it to you here, is within patients. So we have this switch in the stress. In this case, we have the standard state, and E1 is the stress state. So we see these directions of changes, and actually we see that for subject F it's very different. So we have a resilient subject here, and this is a case where we're extremely interested in, there's a dichotomy in, and this is a hidden variable in some sense, that is certain patients respond very differently to antibiotics. And so people who are not resilient, that is, don't bounce back after taking antibiotics, this means that if they take them a second time or a third time, they're going to be susceptible to things like Clostridium difficile and various infections, which come back again and again. So we were able to look at these maps, and this is typically what the biologists like to look at in the sort of ecology setting. And the problem that comes up is, how sure are we of the results? So we're going to talk about how you can combine different studies to get at a level of uncertainty. And this is the same method that we use for multi-table methods, where we generalize the notion of variance and covariance to multi-tables. And this is done in a standard way using the inner products between the operators in the matrices. So these multi-domain coefficients can be used for comparing, for instance, what you have in the KEG functions or the metabolites, and what you have at gene expression level. So this is, for instance, for taxa and mass spec data. We see that we have this high correlation between the KEG data and the different OTUs. But here, I'm going to actually use it for uncertainty quantification. I'm much more interested in making graphics, the equivalent of confidence interval, but confidence regions. So the way we set this up, and this is a paper which is in revision with Boyu Ren, who did a lot of the programming, and Sergio Bacalado, and we did a Bayesian non-parametric and system in which we created a posterior, and we have pics from this posterior. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail. I don't have time to go into too much of the detail of how that was done. But what we have is we have a model which is sort of a standard Gram model for the matrices of distances between the samples. But instead of just projecting all the posterior pics, which would give something like this, which is a mess, we're going to use methods which are very similar to registration. In some sense, we're going to take the representation which minimizes these angles, these RV angles. And the reason we have to do that is if you just do ordinary principal coordinate analysis on the posteriors, you have a switching mechanism between the first and the second axis, or between the direction, between the positive and negative directions in PCA. So you can't directly project the results of your posterior. And so we do this registration where we find the best consensus, and then we can project all the posteriors onto this consensus space. So I'll just show you what you get, and this is much more satisfactory in some sense than just getting an ordination. This gives us confidence regions. These are all non-parametric, so they're not ellipses, but it tells us that we have a strong separation. In fact, here, these were all of one type of subject, and the other ones were the different type. Now here we've colored them, and so here these are the first controls. They're all together except for this one. And so these confidence regions around each of the projections allow us to make inferences in a way that the ecology methods, just ordinary ordination, don't allow us. So this is this visualization of uncertainties has also allow us to improve the design of our studies, because these cases here, which have a very large range in their ISO contours, these we know are very uncertain. So that enables us to resample for these types of data, which are not narrow enough. And all of these points are very narrow, so we know that they're known with high precision. I want to give you an example of the standard workflow and a paper that appeared in Nature, which gives you an idea of one of the problems that comes up in terms of reproducible research, is the conclusion that there are enterotypes in the human gut. And so this is the figure that came out in Nature. And I'm going to just show this in this example, and I want to do the whole workflow, just show you the reproducible research. So I took their data set, and we run through some of what they did. What we realized was that, to begin with, that they've taken proportions on the data, and you can see this because the sums are all one as you go through the different samples. And the other thing that was done on the data is that some of the points were left out. So there are actually 9 points were dropped from a 42-point study. So there's some worry about the reproducibility of the analysis. The next thing that was done was an ordination method, and they used Jensen-Shannon distance, which is not really the standard distance that we use on this type of data, but one has a lot of choices in making distances. In fact, the number of, I'm going through here, we do chi-square, there's Bray-Curtis, which is also a standard distance. You can do metric or non-metric multidimensional scaling, and here I cycled through the 40 different distances which are available in R, and for some of these, you definitely don't see a clear partitioning into groups. You could change the grouping variables, but there are methods for actually finding the number of clusters, whether you use the gap statistic or whether you use different silhouette methods. For finding out how many clusters, but there's definitely not necessarily 3 clusters in the data. When we dropped the outliers, we actually found something slightly different than the original plot, and our ellipses are a little bit larger, and what we realized was they took the labels after clustering and then did a linear discriminant analysis, and that's what they get in this paper. So there are several problems running through and reproducing what was done. And I'd say that the main problem that one could summarize in the following way is that you had to choose a data transformation. I talked about doing subsampling or taking proportions, the original data, or you can do the arcsine hyperbolic or a log or a regularized log. You take a subset of the data, you have a choice of how many points to drop out, and they dropped out 9, so there were quite a lot of choices there. They filtered out certain taxa, and they had to choose a distance, so we have about 40 different choices. You can choose a clustering method, you can choose an underlying continuous variable, either to do grouping or to do a gradient, and you choose a graphical representation. So in the end, if you count the number of possible analyses that's done in this interactive way, you find about 204 million different studies. And the problem as a statistician here, and this is what comes up a lot in what happened for microarrays and what's happening currently for biomarkers, is Benjamin and Hochberg and post-selective inference won't help you. That is, you had 204 million different choices. You can't fix that. How are you going to ensure that what you did is reproducible? And this is giving statistics a bad name, because basically, if you give me any study, I can always find you a significant p-value. I have enough degrees of freedom there, dropping points, doing transformations, that we can always find significant p-values. So p-values won't help. So the only thing that solves that problem is to have a completely transparent process and better reproducibility. Now, one of the big challenges for us is that we work in an interactive framework. That is, we created PhiloSeq, but we have a Chinese app in front of it, so we make the people work in interaction with their data, and it's not necessary that they have a complete record of all the R commands that they use. So what we've done now is we have a snoop. We have something called a provenance tracker. And so we have this shiny interface, and what's happening is there's a listener which is listening to all the transformations and all the things that are being done to the data, so that the user at the end has a complete record of everything that they did. This comes in very useful at several levels. First of all, because we can exchange between collaborators the exact state of the data by exchanging that diary. And then when it comes to publication, we create our markdown file from this record. So we know exactly what we did, and we can publish as supplementary material a cleaned up version of this profile. So in some sense, we can say you can look at the p-values, but to be transparent, these are all the choices that I made. And you can say, well, how does that solve the problem? In some sense, it does, because if you have the data and you run through the script and you make a couple of changes and the results are robust to that change, then you know that there's actually something there. So robustness to changes, I think, is one of the main results of the goal of making science more transparent. It's also because when we do these analyses, it seems that we never stop because it's never optimal. So by being transparent, we can put out the code and say, okay, we had to stop, we've been working on this for 2 years, here is all the code, now you can go and try and do better, or you can try and improve what we did with your better methods. But we can publish because we feel that the transparency in some sense replaces, there's a sort of honest process where we can advance science, but it doesn't have to be perfect. And I think that this goal in some sense of changing where how we do science and being more open about it will further the process rather than put it back. So the goals that we've already attained, we do this data normalization, so we've improved the method in which we avoid any leakage in the data. We have this data integration, we use PhiloSeq, and we can join trees and graphs to the data themselves. And we have high quality graphics and we make plots which involve the evaluation of uncertainty. And we do this uncertainty propagation using a Bayesian, I didn't show you the details, but this is using the Gibbs sampler on a Bayesian low factor model. The interactive graph visualization and shiny PhiloSeq enables this provenance tracking. And I think that's the biggest thing to think about going forward is we could actually use this. We use it also for going back to doing evaluation of our workflow. That is, we can see how the people who are using our system is made to be used only by biologists, so they're definitely not people who understand very well all the implications of the choices that they make. And we try to improve the workflow by looking at what they did. The reproducibility, open source standards, and publication of source code and data is something that I think will further what we do. We are currently doing much more refined dynamic models, the perturbation analysis, the longitudinal analyses for the antibiotic resistance dynamics are very interesting, but we have a lot of correlation with the different bacteria, so the standards sort of Dirichlet multinomial don't work because the bacteria are not independent, and so they work together. And then we have a lot of challenges. We use mass spec and NMR for the proteins, and one of the big problems is annotation. Currently, when we find something which we think is very interesting, and we say, we have this peptide, we think it's a signature, there's only a 1 in 4 chance that the people we work with, the biochemists, actually know what those are. So the annotation and the proteomics is something that we're still working on in terms of databases and annotation. And then I want to thank all the statisticians who, in particular, the R and Bioconductor community that I belong to, because many of the tools that I've used have been developed so that they can be used across fields, and it's definitely the case that that benefits everybody in the long run. And in particular, Wolfgang Huber has developed DSEC2, which is, and Emmanuel Paradis has made this tool for using phylogenetic trees. The tool's called APE, and I use that intently. Finally, my collaborators who provide a lot of the data, which takes years of design and collection to do. So David Relman, with whom I do a lot of the human microbiome, and Alfred Spormann, with whom I work on the soil and the deep sea. Elizabeth Purdom is now an associate professor at Berkeley, but she was the first student with whom I started working on the microbiome, and I did a lot of the Bayesian non-parametrics, which I didn't do in detail here, but I recommend you look at the paper. It's on the archive. I did that with Sergio Bacalado, who was a postdoc with me. And then the people who do mass spec and with whom we're trying to develop better pipeline for actually doing the proteomics are Justin Sonnenberg and Josh Elias. So I thank my lab group, my postdoctoral fellows who've accepted to take much longer to publish the papers because I asked them to publish all their code in a way that other people can read and use, and that sometimes that's a drawback when you're a young person and you're in a hurry to get out a lot of papers. But Joey McMurdy, who now works at a microbiome startup in San Francisco, Ben Callahan, who's just moving to North Carolina State, Christophe Cellier, who's a postdoc with me, and then students who are still in the lab and who are analyzing a lot of microbiome type data. My funding comes from mostly from the NIH, where I have a transformative research grant to study the resilience in antibiotics. And here are the sites that are available on Bioconductor and GitHub, and if you want to, you know, use any of the code, everything's open, so.
Thank you very much for that nice talk. So please come to the microphones for questions.
Hi, I have a question here. Extreme right. Yeah, okay. At the back. So I have a question on your preterm birth studies.
Yes.
Do you also do multimodal studies like using ultrasound where you can use shortening of the cervical length, etc., to along with your microbiome studies?
So for the time being, we're only doing swabs, and we're just trying to find very simple biomarkers.
Okay.
And what happens is, and a follow-up study is now being done, there are many, many different sources of preterm birth. And so we're really trying to identify the unidentified sources. That is, there are patients who are diabetic, there are patients who have various kinds of congenital problems, which we already know are going to give the problem of preterm birth. So in this case, we're just doing it to catch all the cases which we wouldn't know about. So, but we're only doing it in this low, I'd say low-tech way, that is, with these studies.
Okay.
The March of Dimes does have other data collection, but we haven't done anything.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So you mentioned that storing experiments is important, and you talked about the provenance tracker, which I believe is some software package. Do you have like any sort of systems or standards or guidelines that you follow or would recommend for experiment recording?
Well, I mean, the first thing that always happens to recommend, to be honest, is the experimental design at the beginning. And then teaching people who are going to do some of the analysis how, you know, some of the statistics involved is pretty important. So they know what they're seeing and what they have to go for. But I don't have, except that we, you know, we do this tracking, this provenance tracking, in order to have a complete record, but also to give people feedback. And it's difficult to say that we have a one-off feedback because we have some of our researchers who use the system who just won't let go. That is, they want something perfect and they'll go on doing an analysis for, I'd say, a year. And I think that's the problem of thinking too much. That is, statistics, you have to understand that the data are noisy, so you can't go all the way down to explaining every little blip in the data. So I don't have a general answer about the tracking, except that we find it useful.
Thank you.
There's one last question over there.
Yeah.
So obesity is a huge problem for the United States. It's, I think, a growing problem worldwide. And there has been some studies showing at least a correlation between obesity and the intestinal biome. So there is even some attempts to do the intestinal biome transplantation. As a cure against obesity. So do you have an opinion in this area, and is it like promising technology?
Well, I understand. There are many aspects to that. One of the things you have to know is that in the US, there's antibiotics in the food chain. And large amounts of antibiotics in mouse and rats in certain lead to obesity. And it's exactly the reason why they give antibiotics to cattle. It makes them get fatter quicker. And so there's a lot of resistance in the US to studying certain associations between obesity and the microbiome. But I think it's a very important area. So we're concentrated on antibiotics, but I think that general obesity, and now people, you know, one of the things is in the US there's many more C-sections. The babies are born with C-sections, but babies who start off, who were born through C-sections have a very different microbiome than babies who were born naturally. And so the association between the microbiome and obesity is definite. The idea of where it actually comes from and which are the places where you can make the most useful interventions, that's not so sure.
Thank you.
So in the interest of your coffee, I'd like to stop here. Let's thank Susan again for her great talk.